Monday, December 9th, Mylinda's first wedding anniversary, was a day so full at the White House that I felt like I was going through it on roller skates. Events and groups followed so fast on each other's heels that you could almost have made a musical comedy out of it if you had had time to laugh. At one point, after my group of engineers had left a little past 6, and before the astronauts came at 8, I came upon the housekeeper, Mary Kaltman, busily plying the carpet sweeper herself at the head of the stairs, tidying up for the next event. And best laid plans came thudding down around my ears. In the middle of the afternoon, there was a visit from Bess and Jim Ketchum, with disaster written on their faces, and began the foreboding. We've been putting off telling you this, and hoping we wouldn't have to, but we feel that you must know. So that I felt at least the Washington by Gilbert Stuart must have been stolen in the night. But no, the problem was that one of my long-sought aims, which I now thought had been brought to happy conclusion, that is, the acquisition of the Madison portrait, which we were going to celebrate with a reception on Thursday afternoon. This aim, so nearly achieved, had foundered. It appeared the owner from whom we had bought it was in the throes of getting a divorce and had turned over the proceeds of the check for the portrait to the lady he was in love with in Germany. And his wife was bringing suit, not for the picture, to which he did not claim title, at least they so assured me, but to a portion of the proceeds. And so, if we didn't want the White House mixed up in a messy front-page divorce proceedings, we had best quietly keep the Madison in the curator's office and let Mrs. Nixon hang it probably next year sometime, when the divorce case was settled. By the time they had finished, I was greatly relieved. Apparently, the house will still have the portrait. It's just that I won't get the credit. I thought it was dear of them, of Jim, and very especially of Bess, to care so much. And as if this weren't enough, sometime during the day, Liz called me with storm signals in her voice. She had asked Jerry Vanderhubble to try to find out what color Mrs. Nixon's inaugural dress would be. Jerry had just notified her it would be red. Sometime last week, I had finally made the decision on the lovely swatch of red wool for a coat and dress ensemble to be bought through iMagnons. This must be canceled, of course, and we must start all over, and quick. The day began early, and there was a nice picture of Linda walking down a Hong Kong street. The dateline said Bangkok, so she had reached there, but Chuck, not yet. Bess and Carol and Marilyn and I met in the early morning on the Christmas list, which had proliferated from 14 pages to 35. Sometime last week, and I had called an SOS, and they were making suggestions, and I asked Marilyn to feed it to me 25 or 50 a day, because I want to save out Christmas. I want Christmas itself to be unhurried and deeply savored every moment of it. A series of calls, and then finally a solid hour with Harry McPherson going over the list of oral history names which Dr. France had prepared. I had done the same thing with George Reedy on Saturday. I looked to Bill Deason as my judge and assistant on Lyndon's early days, that is, up through NYA, George through the House and the Senate, and Harry through the vice presidency and the presidency, although of course there is much overlapping. We had weighed and evaluated, scratched out many names, put a priority on some, and I think produced a much more realistic list. I had lunch on a tray in my room alone. And then the sad but almost comical meeting with Bess and Jim. So much for 5 years of searching. And then into an afternoon dress into the Army Navy Club, where there was a reception honoring Jane Freeman. Bess and Marsha and Helene rode with me. A brief stay, I stood in line with Jane and met a lot of city officials and Girl Scouts and garden club ladies and conservation workers. She was receiving an honor from them, and I wanted to be there to add my words of praise and fondness. And then quickly back to the White House, where at 5 o'clock in the yellow oval room, I met with Alan Boyd and 35 highway engineers. They were all young men who were just completing an 18-month training program in federal construction project offices, and they were scheduled to go out and work in different states where federal money is being spent to make sure it's being used according to the philosophy of the Transportation Department, which under Allen Boyd has meant building roads with some regard to aesthetics, to the social problems of the people that it affects, and to historic landmarks and parklands. There was an ample tea tray set up, and also drinks were passed. Karen was with us, of course, and a good deal of the hierarchy of the Bureau of Public Roads, including Mr. Frank Turner. I talked and they talked about how building roads was affecting the face of our country. Alan and I had planned this, hopefully, as a small shot in the arm, maybe. A sort of a last planting of a seed on my part for beautification in years to come as it would rest in the hands of these young men. It was a pleasant exchange. Finally, I said, anybody want to ask any questions? Yes, said one young man. Are you going to be sorry to leave here? I laughed. It always gets back what people are really interested in. Yes, how does it feel to be First Lady? What do you do? Will you be sorry to see it end? It is a very personal thing. How could it not be? After about an hour, I said goodbye. And this time I lay down exhausted, getting a rub, but working at the same time innumerable telephone calls to Walt Rostow about Friday in Mexico, to Carol Carlisle about tonight's seating list, Leonard Marks about setting another meeting and the agenda for the audiovisual committee, and Wayne Grover. This had been the last straw today, a shattering letter from him saying that he felt it was time that he went off the payroll and would like to, as of December the 20th, for the library. I told him quite simply I very much hoped he would stay on until at least February the 20th. I could not urge, I could only express the feeling that it would be a very much better handled project if he did stay, as a minimum until then. And he agreed. I have found myself working, as Lyndon so often does, while he gets a rub or just lies in bed, reading innumerable reports, making innumerable phone calls, doing two things at once, as it were. And then, at 7, it was time for Mr. Pear to give me an up hairdo and put on my lovely cloth of Thailand dress and go into the yellow oval room to greet our honored guests. We had asked to come upstairs, Jim and Patsy Webb and 6 of the astronauts, Cunninghams, Isleys, and Shiraz. These had flown on Apollo 7 in October. And the Anders, Bormans, and Lovells, these men would fly on the Apollo 8 in December. And of course, Jim and Patsy's children, Sarah, an attractive young woman of college age, I thought, and James Webb, Jr., who's at Princeton, and his brother and sister-in-law, the Gorham Webbs. In all these parties, we try very much to have the families of those we are honoring. It adds to the meaning of the occasion, to the honoree, I think. And, as always, with us, Muriel and Hubert, who add immeasurably to any party. And we'd ask the Charles Lindberghs, of whom, I must admit, I stood in more awe than anybody there, but he seemed to have a good time and to be quite easy. I noticed him sort of rocking backwards and forwards on his heels, listening intently to a group of the astronauts, and I joined them, and we talked of the Earth Resources satellite, the most exciting thing in the whole program to me. The extraordinary group of young people, these men, and versatile. It interests me the way the space program has used the astronauts themselves as a sort of a PR instrument to explain the space program to the country at all sorts of events, from a harvest festival in Iowa to a dinner at the White House. There's likely to be an astronaut as a sort of an ambassador from the space program, and they are easy, articulate, many-faceted people, those I've met. After a drink and a little visiting, and Lyndon's circling the room, speaking to everyone, Bess gently gathered us up and piloted us, that is, Lyndon and I and Jim and the 6 astronauts and Hubert, I was the only woman in the group, into the treaty room. Tonight, we would have a different picture. And then, rather hanging back, Mr. Lindbergh was being ushered into the room. I'll bet it was Liz's idea. We'd set the stage earlier in the day, and an exciting one it was. President Grant's table crossways at the end of the room. with 6 chairs for the astronauts, and on the table spread open the 2 books that are the space treaties signed during my husband's tenure as president. The one that says there will be no warheads on satellites in space, and the other that says that signatory nations will attempt to give aid to astronauts down in the wrong country, or help them in any way they can.